From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just 3 weeks from now, UN weapons inspectors will present their findings on Iraq to the Security Council. That could be the trigger to war. Whether you support war or not, everyone now hears the clock ticking, especially Saddam Hussein. With his back against the wall, the Iraqi dictator is unpredictable. He could fight. He could flee. He could launch a counterstrike on American soil with the very weapons of mass destruction Washington wants to destroy. This hour, On Point, endgame options for Saddam and for the U.S. on the home stretch to war. We begin with the latest developments in the Persian Gulf. In a televised speech today to mark Iraqi Armed Forces Day, Saddam Hussein called UN weapons inspectors spies and denounced Americans as wicked assistants to Satan. The tough talk comes on the heels of announcements from Washington that the U.S. is assembling a force that could number some 200,000 in the region by February. Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked for his assessment of troop movements around Iraq.
Probably we're seeing a very clever campaign going on at the moment, more a psychological warfare campaign than anything else. There is a slow and steady build-up of troops, moving from a figure Army, Navy and Air Force, US mainly at the moment, of about 50 to 60,000. And it's looking as though in the next 3 weeks to a month that figure could get very, very much higher and could easily go past the 100,000 figure. But I have to stress here that there is a psychological campaign directed against Saddam Hussein and his regime in Baghdad.
To what end?
Well, basically to get him to go, to get him either removed by his own people or to force him to go into exile. And there are all sorts of reports running around, and it's difficult to verify them. But it is possible that President Assad, when he visited Tony Blair in London just before Christmas, was talking to Tony Blair about providing a safe haven for Saddam Hussein if he decided to flee from Iraq and for him to go into Syria. And we got some reports out of Syria that, in fact, that some discussions had taken place about allowing both Saddam Hussein and 200 to 300 of his immediate circle to go into Syria. But as far as we know, the Syrians aren't keen on that.
Charles Heyman, let me be sure I understand what you're saying. If the U.S., U.K. and others were serious about going straight to war, would you expect to see a different kind of buildup than we're seeing now?
Yeah, I would expect to have seen really the mobilization of reserves much, much sooner and a far, far more concentrated effort to get both personnel and equipment into that Gulf theater of operations. An awful lot being done before Christmas. This looks to be a very, very steady build-up. At the end of the day, almost certainly, George Bush and Tony Blair are determined to go to war if it's necessary. But it looks as though they're trying everything in their power to force this issue to its end without recourse to a huge military operation like the one we saw in 1991.
In other words, raise the temperature step by step, have the troops sitting around Iraq. But ultimately, would this troop configuration be prepared to go to war in the manner in which it's being deployed?
Oh, yes. I think there's no doubt about that whatsoever. The correct sort of people are going with the correct sort of equipment. But it is slow and it is steady. I mean, for example, last week we had a raft of announcements from the US DOD about the sort of people who were being brought back into service, reserves, and the troops and units that will be going to the Gulf.
Nevertheless, Donald Rumsfeld is saying, apparently, that by mid-February there would be 200,000 U.S. troops in the Gulf region. That sounds like a go-to-war-ready figure.
I would say that the way things are going at the moment, 200,000 by mid-February is probably pushing it a bit. You can't just dump these soldiers down in the Gulf and expect them to go to war tomorrow. They really have to get themselves acclimatized. They have to get themselves shaken out. They have to marry themselves up with their equipment. And some sort of exercises have to take place to make sure that the whole thing is properly joined up. Now, it is possible that a limited operation could take place in the Gulf during, say, mid-February. Maybe an operation designed to put yet more pressure on the regime.
Taking Basra, for example?
Taking Basra, closing the Scud box in western Iraq. But I don't think, with the way things are going at the moment, that the great 1991 rerun of the Gulf War would be possible by mid-February. That is possible, but it would probably come much later.
Is there a climate deadline here or not? We were told that they wanted to fight when it was cool, that late spring, early summer would be too hot. Is that, in fact, a deadline?
Well, I don't think there is a deadline there. I think really what we are saying is that military operations in the summer in Iraq, in the high summer, would be very, very difficult. But they wouldn't be impossible. It would be difficult for soldiers to operate normally, especially if they were suited up for nuclear, biological and chemical conditions. But it would be possible to keep pressure on the regime by using air power, using selective strikes on the ground and things like that. But I think it would be very, very difficult, probably verging on impossible, to have a massive military operation running in June or July.
So if there's going to be a significant, a large military operation, by when would it have to kick off?
I think that we're really, really talking about it kicking off by the beginning of April. Remember that we're expecting, and I think...
As late as that.
No real reason to expect that this campaign would last for weeks or months. The signs from inside Iraq do suggest that the Iraqi army is not really prepared to fight. The Iraqi army's morale is being sapped by the day. With the psychological operation that's going on, with this huge build-up of troops steadily going on bit by bit, and also the Iraqi army is being targeted by a radio station, which we think is broadcasting from Kuwait, and we're told that there is leafleting going on now as well. The Iraqi army know if they move out of barracks, they're going to be destroyed by Allied air power.
So what about Saddam Hussein himself? Any sign, even the smallest sign of a step toward overthrow or exit?
Well, as you can imagine, we've been watching this very, very carefully. We don't think even the smallest signs yet of an exit, but there are signs that he is rattled. And just anecdotally, I mean, somebody spoke to me just after Saddam Hussein's broadcast this afternoon.
On Army Day in Baghdad.
Yeah, the Army Day broadcast that he made, and said that he was in a cafe in Baghdad when this was going on, and he said probably 90% of the people in that coffee shop, and there were 40 or 50 of them in there, did not stop playing draughts and checkers.
They were not paying attention to the president's strident speech.
They were not paying any attention whatsoever. And he said he was getting the impression from people, although they were very frightened to talk, that most people say this is Saddam Hussein's problem, not ours. Let's hope that the coalition, if they do go to war, just get it over with as quickly as possible.
So you're talking about psychological warfare, turning the screw tighter and tighter, potentially going in for some limited operations around the periphery of Iraq that would further tighten the noose around Saddam, but not going in a la 1991 with a massive force anytime very soon.
Absolutely, not very soon. I think that the majority of commentators, certainly here in the UK, have missed the point here that George Bush and Tony Blair do not want to go to war. They will only go to war in the very, very last instance. And they will try everything else in their power other than go to war to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
And what if they misjudge Saddam, or what if he misjudges them? If the noose gets too tight, might he not pull out his weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, other, against U.S. troops or against U.S. civilians?
Well, you've got it in one. This is the problem with a policy of this sort. You can't dictate events. You can only hope that events go your way. I think at the end of the day, though, and this is having watched Saddam Hussein for many, many years, I think that he is a survivalist. He is intent on survival. That is the most important thing to him. In survival for himself, first of all, and then for the small group of people around him that he actually trusts. And I think that there is a good chance that we may get away with this without the great war that everybody is predicting. But it's still open, I'm afraid.
Charles Heyman, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke to us earlier from Shrewsbury, England. We're talking tonight about endgame options in the home stretch to war. U.S. and allied troops are circling Iraq, and the war noose is tightening. Saddam appears to have few options left, but he has some. In October, CIA Director George Tenet wrote that if war comes, it might be Saddam's, quote, last chance to exact vengeance, unquote, on America. Saddam might pull his weapons of mass destruction up out of the sand and use them on Americans in America. The Iraqi dictator could try to go down in that blaze of gruesome glory. What do you think? Will he fight? Will he flee?
Could the threat of war, capture, and death actually push Saddam to use his weapons of mass destruction? What is the end game here? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Teaneck, New Jersey tonight is Richard Betts, director of the Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University and author of Suicide from Fear of Death, an article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. Good evening and welcome, Richard Betts.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us. Well, there we've just heard in one interview and in your work as well, an array of endgame options as everything seems to tighten up here. We're looking at exile, overthrow, a surprise attack potentially on the U.S. Using weapons of mass destruction, presumably biological or chemical. What among these is foremost on your mind as you sit and watch what's going on around Iraq this evening, Richard Betts?
Well, I'm most concerned about the possibility of a counterattack if the U.S. invasion of Iraq, if it comes, succeeds. Because it's a possibility that really hasn't been discussed in the public debate anywhere near as much as it should be. People are talking more about the dangers to our forces operating in Iraq or the possibility that Iraq might strike back against Israel or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. But there's been very little discussion of the possibility that if Saddam Hussein knows he's going down, knows he's got nothing to look forward to but defeat, that he would try to retaliate by smuggling in and setting off biological weapons in the United States if he could.
Does Saddam Hussein have the capacity to do that?
Well, we don't know. And hopefully the answer is that they just wouldn't be competent enough to bring it off, that Iraqi intelligence would be too clumsy to smuggle the weapons in, or that the terrorists they might subcontract the job to would bungle it. Or that other things would work out to our advantage. The problem is it's risky to bank on maybes. And if we attack and if we succeed, then he has no incentive to hold back. He does have an incentive to hold back as long as he thinks he might survive, as long as he thinks he can continue to play the game and hope that something may turn up. But if he knows he's going down, there's no reason for him not to try to take some of us with him.
At what point, Richard Betts, do you think Saddam Hussein might conclude he's going down? We just heard Charles Heyman saying he believes it's still a waiting game, still a pressure game. But at some point, that ticks over into something else, where his back really is against the wall, where the threat is imminent. Do you think we're there now? Are you concerned about this counterattack any minute, or is it something in the future?
I think it's most likely if the war has started and it's evident that the United States is succeeding, that Baghdad is going to be overrun, and that Saddam Hussein's regime is history. Until then, he's not likely to do this because he knows it would be begging to set off exactly those consequences, which he could still hope to avoid.
You write that the United States, in going to war with Iraq, is about to use your words, poke a snake. But of course, and that is to go after something dangerous. But, of course, the argument has been from Washington exactly that, that there's danger here and that we have to go out and deal with it.
Sure. The problem is this is one of those issues where the choices are only between a risky option and a riskier one. There is a risk in relying on deterrence and containment to deal with Saddam Hussein, as we have for the last dozen years. But while that's risky, it's not as risky as starting a war that could bring on exactly what it is that it's meant to prevent.
And paint a picture of that. What do you most fear? What's your, I guess, nightmare scenario there?
Well, the nightmare scenario would be that if the American invasion succeeds, Saddam Hussein would give orders to implement plans that he might have made in advance to retaliate with the weapons of mass destruction that we believe he has. There's no clear end to the war in sight. If he thinks he's likely to survive, then he'll probably continue to hold back. But this would probably depend on what he's been able to arrange in advance.
And you believe that's a real possibility?
Yes, it's probably less than a 50% likelihood. But if the odds are, say, just 1 out of 6, that's the same as Russian roulette. I don't think it's highly likely, but it's too likely for comfort.
Richard Betts, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about endgame options in the home stretch to war, Saddam's options, including hitting the U.S. at home, and America's options. Put yourself in Saddam's shoes. What would you do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about endgame options in the home stretch to war, about Saddam Hussein's options, including hitting the United States at home with those infamous weapons of mass destruction he is supposed to have, and America's options. Put yourself in Saddam's shoes. What would you do as you get pushed up against the wall? What about exile? Would you be satisfied to see Saddam in a big house on Lake Geneva? If Saddam is cornered, would he hit, could he hit the United States at home? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Richard Betts. He's director of the Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University and author of an article in the current Foreign Affairs magazine, which lays out in some detail a threat that he calls very real. No saying exactly what the probability is, but enough that it should be taken into account. Richard Betts, you say, and it seems clearly true from the conversation in the U.S., that this possibility of Saddam hitting Americans not in the Iraq area, but at home, has barely been discussed. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's hard for me to figure out. I think in part it's because the people in the administration who believe it's necessary to go to war believe it's a risk that's worth taking and see no point in getting people alarmed or undermining their own case. I think still, even despite the events of September 11th, psychologically, a lot of Americans still don't think of us as being that vulnerable to a catastrophe inflicted on us by some half-pint dictator. And finally, I think it's because some people understandably think, in a sense, that it's dishonorable to feel that we should be deterred or frightened by a threat from Saddam Hussein, and that it would be wimpy to let our decisions be constrained by that.
Well, what about that logic? I mean, that's pretty much the message, is we don't want to live in perpetual fear of a man with this man's track record, so let's go take care of business here.
Well, if you could solve the problem by taking care of business without suffering the consequences of retaliation, that might be a good idea. But this is a problem we've lived with before. We had 40 years of Cold War with the Soviet Union, where we didn't enjoy living with the fact that the Soviets could launch thousands of nuclear weapons at us any time, but we dealt with the problem as best we could, with mutual deterrence, and that worked.
You think it would work here again?
I think there's no reason to assume it wouldn't. Saddam Hussein is a survivor. He's a thug. He's not a religious fanatic. He's interested in how he does in this world. And he doesn't really have any reason to do something that he knows would bring down massive American retaliation on him. Now, we can't be assured of that, but you do the best you can when you're living with threatening enemies.
And you quoted a 1993 study that talks about a million or more deaths in the Washington, D.C. area as a result of an anthrax attack. Is that what we're really talking about here, or is that some kind of outdated, exaggerated picture?
That estimate was probably exaggerated because, for one thing, medical readiness is better now, and there would probably be a more effective response. But even if you discount that number by 90 or 99%, you're still talking about a lot more casualties than on September 11th. So even a limited or a clumsy attack could be very devastating. One problem is, I think some people, thinking back to the anthrax letters that were delivered a year ago, have lost sight of the fact that that was a very inefficient way to attempt to use anthrax. And I think some people have thought of anthrax as a threat that really wasn't that bad because so few people suffered from it at that time. What we really have to worry about is anthrax delivered by an effective aerosol device from an airplane, or, as some people are focusing on now, smallpox, although I think that's a less likely threat than anthrax or chemical weapons.
So you say, rather than put his back against the wall, let's push for him to go into exile, or maybe let's array U.S. forces around Iraq in some way that keeps the pressure on, but that's shy of a mortal threat to him.
Yeah, as long as you're not threatening to put him out of business, not just politically, but probably to end his life, which is likely if he's out of power, he's got too many enemies to let him live for very long. As long as you're not threatening that, he's got an incentive to hold back his highest cards. It's when he doesn't have any possibilities to look forward to that he loses that incentive to hold back.
And off they could go. Let's take a quick call. Steve's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll try to make my point quickly and hopefully effectively. I think the underlying assumptions are incorrect. I think the real question is, do evil people need to be cornered before they act in evil ways? And in fact, Hussein has proven that he doesn't need to be cornered to act in evil ways. He attacked Kuwait. Was he cornered? Go back through history. Was Japan cornered when they attacked Pearl Harbor? Well, you could say that we cut off some oil supplies
or
whatever, but were the people in Japan starving? No. Was Hitler cornered when he attacked Poland and Czechoslovakia? Was Russia cornered when they took over all of Eastern Europe?
So you say, let's go for it.
Was Khmer Rouge cornered when they killed a billion people and a gazillion people in Cambodia?
Steve, we've got it. Let me put it straight to Richard Betts. How about it?
2 points. Fortunately, none of those former cases involved enemies that had weapons of mass destruction. But secondly, the biggest mistake Saddam Hussein made was in attacking Kuwait when the United States did not even try to deter him. We gave him a green light, unfortunately. The solution now is to make it clear to him that we won't let him get away with anything. And we did make that clear in the war in 1991, the successful Persian Gulf War. We made it clear that we won't let him get away with it since then. And for a dozen years, he's stayed in the box.
That is, we wouldn't let him get away with staying in Kuwait or using his chemical or biological weapons in 91.
Or attacking any of his neighbors again.
But this time, the message is you're going down, and you're saying that's a dangerous message, but you can hear in Steve's call that urge to go in and deal with it, not have it continue to sit there as a threat.
Yes, if we could do that at low cost, I'd be all for it. He's somebody who deserves to be out of business, to say the least. He's as bad as they get in international politics.
But the cost, you're saying, is not clear. Richard Betts, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Michael Donovan. He joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. He's military and terrorism analyst at the Center for Defense Information. Good evening and welcome, Michael Donovan.
Good evening.
You've been listening. We're talking about endgame options here. On the one hand, for Saddam Hussein, whether he might go into exile has been talked about in the last few days. A lot of Arab governments would like to see that. He might reach out and hit the United States or try to if things get serious enough. On the other side, it's the United States and its allies with their endgame. At the top of the hour, we heard they're not really eager to go to war here. They'd rather pull the noose a bit tighter and a bit tighter and hope that Saddam is overthrown or flees. When you look out at the U.S. Array of forces militarily, is that what you see, a waiting game for the time being?
Yeah, I think that there's not actually a lot I can add to what I thought was an excellent analysis by Major Humor at the beginning of the hour. Mm-hmm. I think that for the time being, the administration and some of our willing allies aren't extremely excited to go into Iraq. And I think that derives from an array of political and economic factors as well as just some of the concerns that we've outlined here tonight.
So you agree that at the moment there's a kind of psychological warfare going on, hoping that something cracks in Baghdad?
Oh, absolutely. I think that this has been the linchpin of the American approach to Saddam Hussein since September 11th is the credible use of force in the hope that that might precipitate something that would make all of this academic in the end.
That raises a lot of questions then, and let's go first to the one that Richard Betts raises. As the noose is tightened, at some point it may not be clear to Saddam whether it's just pressure or it's an imminent threat to his survival. What's your sense of the U.S. military's level of concern about him pulling up some weapon of mass destruction out of the sands and using it on U.S. troops in the theater or against Americans at home?
I would say that, obviously I can't speak for the American military, but my sense is that the first scenario, the idea that the Iraqis might use chemical or biological weapons tactically on the battlefield, more probably chemical weapons than biological weapons, mm-hmm. Would use those tactically on the battlefield has been assumed to be a given in the Pentagon.
That they will do it.
Absolutely. And I think that this is something that Pentagon planners have been planning for since day one. It's a contingency nobody wants to see. But it is something that I think, if only for the sake of prudence, planners have been accepting as a given from day one.
And what does that mean for U.S. military operations? How does it change strategically the way the U.S. can, should go in? It's more than just putting on suits.
Well, it changes things or it constrains things on a number of different levels. First of all, it means that you've really got to do the job yourself, you, your British allies, the professional militaries. You can't use proxies because proxies, in part, they have a number of reasons why they're problematic, but they certainly aren't trained or equipped to deal with weapons of mass destruction.
So the Afghan model would not work here.
Exactly. It also constrains the timetable. There's been a lot of discussion about how politically costly this might be if an invasion of Iraq proved to be a drawn out scenario, and we know. If we know one thing about the use of these weapons on the battlefield, we know is that it dramatically slows down armies. And an army, even a mechanized army as professional as the United States Army, can be expected to slow down something like 30% to 40%.
But that means that there's a huge premium on lightning speed if they can pull it off.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what about the threat to the U.S. mainland, which Richard Betts is raising here and saying it hasn't been talked much about, but it's very real enough that it should be taken into consideration. Richard Betts says the American people deserve loud, clear, and detailed instructions about how to deal with such an attack by Iraq.
Well, I think that at least on that level, I couldn't agree more. I think that if we're going to be upfront about what a war entails with the American public, we should do so immediately. I'm more sanguine, I think, than Mr. Betts is regarding the possibility that Iraq has the capabilities to effect a mass casualty attack with these weapons on the American homeland. But at the same time, I agree with them 110% that this is a contingency that has to be discussed and planned for.
Richard Betts, give us a little more on the capacity front. How real a threat do you think this might be?
Well, we don't know exactly how many of what kinds of biological and chemical weapons Saddam Hussein still has, but the circumstantial evidence is that they have managed to keep and hide a fair number of both. And indeed, that's the reason that the Bush administration is giving for why we're justified in going to war. The real problem is likely to be whether they can find a way to get them into this country, to have personnel who were competent enough to get them to the right places and set them off effectively. That's a much bigger challenge.
But your suggestion that the Bush administration is sugarcoating or downplaying unrealistically that possibility suggests that there is a real possibility. Do you have reason to believe that Iraq could actually deliver these weapons to the continental U.S.?
Well, we don't have reason to assume that they couldn't, and that's my concern. I don't know what the probability is. Maybe it's 1 out of 5, maybe it's 1 out of 10. But I think it's a lot more than 1 out of 100, and that's why I think it deserves more discussion.
Michael Donovan, what about it? Richard Betts says that we're wrong to assume that the blood price in this war will all be paid in the theater around Iraq. Your thoughts?
As I said, I think prudence demands that that you assume the worst and hope for the best. I think that you have to take responsible steps to protect the American people. Even in terms of civil defense. I do believe, going back to a point that was made earlier, that it needs to be, it's a issue that I'm ambivalent about. I still haven't made up my mind completely about this, but I am uncomfortable with the idea of what it seems to me is almost a self-deterrence, that we are concerned that Saddam is enough of a bad guy that he might use these weapons in the last resort against a civilian population in the United States. If that's the case, I think that all the more reason why the argument should be dealing with him, focused on dealing with him before he develops worse weapons than he already has.
So you take the administration's line that, okay, if he would do that, all the more reason to go get him. Richard Betts?
Well, the problem again is why that's not riskier than relying on deterrence and containment, which we did with enemies who were every bit as bad as Saddam Hussein, such as Stalin and Mao Zedong, who people forget until Nixon's surprise rapprochement was considered back in the 1960s as wild and crazy as Saddam Hussein is today.
Yes, he was. Michael Donovan, how about that?
Well, I hope that not to lead this discussion off on too much of a tangent, but I think that those are excellent points. I think that the problem with those points can be things like the fact that both China and the Soviet Union during the Cold War had stakes in an international system, whereas Saddam Hussein is inherently at odds with regional system that's confronting him now. people have written at length about what kind of decision maker he is, and of course this is always open to debate and conjecture, but I think that there's a case to be made that he's a very crude decision maker who tends to miscalculate and accept risks at, in the most optimistic light.
Of course, Stalin and Mao were both challenging international order in their own way. Let's get some calls in here. James is on the line. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Great discussion going on here, and I have a couple of observations and maybe a quick question.
Okay.
The observation is there's no doubt that this guy is a complete lunatic, back into a corner he would use weapons of mass destruction. But the idea that he would use biological weapons seems to be a little bit far-fetched because biological weapons do not respect borders, and even if he did use weapons of mass destruction that are biological in nature, even in the United States, eventually, the destruction would reach far beyond the United States borders and other countries.
Okay, so take biological off the table. Do you think he would? Do you think he could use anthrax in the U.S.?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that he would if he had the capability of effectively delivering it. The question I have is: does the panel that you're discussing these points with have a feeling that maybe this is a great game of high-stakes poker where barrels of oil are the chips being played against? I'll take my answer after you.
We got it. Thank you, James. Michael Donovan, I guess there's no question that this is a great game of poker going on by everyone's description tonight, but do you boil it down to oil?
Well, you know, everybody wants to know, is this a neocolonial bid for oil? I get that question a lot, and the short answer is, what kind of car do you drive? I don't think that all things being equal, if this was Zimbabwe, we would be exerting ourselves to the degree we are. But nevertheless, we do see rogue states around the world as posing a potential threat to the United States, and what is happening in North Korea is an excellent example of how one situation or one size does not fit all. But there's no oil to speak of in North Korea except that oil that we send them. So the threat that is posed here is very real. Does the fact that the Middle East possess the vast majority of the world's proven petroleum resources make a difference? Yes, absolutely it does.
We are talking tonight about endgame options in the home stretch to war with Iraq, about Saddam's options, including hitting the U.S. at home, about America's options. We'll come back and talk about golden parachutes and maybe an overthrow and maybe U.S. options as well. If Saddam is cornered, would he hit the U.S. at home? Is Washington provoking the very thing it's seeking to prevent? If Saddam is up against the wall, does he have any reason not to strike America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Richard Betts and Michael Donovan. We'll be right back with much more. Stay tuned. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about endgame options in the home stretch to war, about Saddam Hussein's options, about Washington's options. Would Washington rather have Saddam flee on his own or to send in U.S. troops to create a new order? Does a quick, low-cost war seem inevitable to you? Or are you ready for surprises? And I guess finally, is the U.S. sufficiently prepared for the possibility of an Iraqi attack, a counterattack, with weapons of mass destruction? We're at 1-800-423-8255. George is on the line. Hi, George. You're on the air. Hello, George. Are you there? Sorry, we lost George. Let me put the golden parachute question to you, Richard Betts. Do you see the news in the last day or two has Arab leaders signaling that they would love for Saddam just to clear out and for the entire war to be avoided? Charles Heyman was saying at the top of the hour that George Bush and Tony Blair would love that as well. You've watched Saddam. I'll ask Michael Donovan the same thing. But do you believe this is a real option, that he might pull up stakes and get out of there?
Possible, but not likely. The problem is that it would be pretty hard for him to go very many places other than someplace like Syria, where he also has a lot of enemies. It would be hard for him to go very many places where all the people in the world who have good reason to want to kill him would be unable to get at him. So I think he would view that as a last resort.
But there's conversation about Russia offering him a place, Belarus, Egypt, Libya, Mauritania. People note that Idi Amin still lives in exile in Saudi Arabia, right next door.
Well, we should try it. It's an option that ought to be looked at. But that wouldn't necessarily solve the whole problem. His whole regime has to go if you want to have much assurance that you've got a shot at solving the problem that we say is the reason for war. If just he and a few cronies go, but the Ba'ath Party apparatus that has controlled Iraq stays in place, mm-hmm. then we're still not going to have much confidence that they're not going to be as much of a problem sometime down the road.
Michael Donovan, Richard Boucher, the State Department spokesman, has said that Saddam must either change his ways or change his venue. Is the U.S. military leaving an exit path for this man? Is there a way he could get out alive if he wanted to?
Well, I think Mr. Betts hit the nail on the head on most counts. I think that it's possible, but not likely. Syria spent a number of years trying to kill Saddam.
Maybe not a real attractive destination for him.
He's got very few attractive destinations from the perspective of a man who's concerned with his own personal security. And I think that the more important point, which was just made, is that really you're talking about a number of people, probably in the tens of thousands, whose fate have been for the last 25 years mm-hmm. intertwined with that of Saddam Hussein.
At least.
You
mean in his regime and his larger Ba'ath apparatus?
Exactly. And the tribal and clannish affiliations.
Right.
And it's going to be a far more complicated maneuver than just sending Saddam on board an airplane to another country. And it would be complicated, to say the least.
So what about the other side of this, the overthrow scenario? We heard from Charles Heyman and others that the message is being sent into Iraq just every way the U.S. can to the Iraqi armed forces, don't support this man. And I guess the implicit message is you'd be well rewarded if you overthrew him. Any sign whatsoever of a path to that outcome?
Nothing I see as of yet. I mean, I think that Saddam is wrapped like an onion in multiple layers of true believers. He's got people that are not true believers in the religious sense, but whose fate, as I said, are intertwined with his. And the consequence of that is that whatever happens in a post Saddam Iraq looks like is not going to be an attractive post Iraq for those people who were closely associated with Saddam Hussein.
Close enough to overthrow him.
So these are the people that are bound themselves mm-hmm. around him. The possibility that one of them might try to sell Saddam down the river for their own escape has always been there. I think it will be there. I think that the credible threat of force on the other end will keep it there. But you're essentially running into the problems you've had ever since people started talking about coups in Iraq.
Which makes it sound as though you're not too optimistic about this endgame shy of war scenario that everyone's wishing for here, which brings us right back around to Saddam Hussein up against the wall and what he might do there. Tony's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I just wanted to say that I think one thing that kind of gets overlooked in this discussion, and I greatly respect the people that are speaking here today, but when you pull off some kind of attack with the military as effective and admittedly as efficient as ours is, even if it's like 60% effective, Saddam and his regime are going to have their hands so full with attacks and the loss of the chain of command
yeah.
and bombings that they're going to – I don't believe that he'll be able to pull off anything like this very successfully.
Tony, we've got your radio in the background, so I want to just take your question and put it straight to our guest, but thank you for calling. Richard Betts, here's the challenge again, and what appears to be a kind of bedrock belief in the U.S., that the attack will be so swift, so overwhelming, so overpowering, that Saddam Hussein is not going to have the time, the luxury, the option of pressing a counterattack.
Well, I hope so. And if we're lucky, things will work out fine, and people can remember these sorts of warnings as needless alarmism. But one problem is we've given him an awful lot of time to think about this and an awful lot of time to think about his options, because this coming war is about the most telegraphed punch in military history. We've been telling him for months that the Americans are coming. So I think the question is whether he has tried to develop an option that could be implemented on his orders. If not, great.
He has been audacious in the past. I mean, are we going to get a phone call from Saddam saying, I've got a tramp freighter in New York Harbor, and if you don't get off my back, it's going to explode?
Well, again, I don't think it's likely, probably less by a long shot than 50% likely, mm-hmm. but it's not a very tiny probability. It's an unknown, but it's one that you logically have to worry about, because if you smack somebody, you've got to assume he's going to be interested in smacking back.
Especially if your smack is intended to be fatal. Michael Donovan, we're coming to the end of our time here, but everyone, I guess, believes that this can be a quick campaign. Yet, as Richard Betts says, the windup has been extraordinarily long. Do you continue to have a concern that during that long windup, Saddam may have laid plans for some counterstrike, even if he's down and out when it comes?
You know, how can you not have a concern about this? I see no reason to underestimate the nefarious ambitions of somebody like Saddam Hussein. We can only hope that the capabilities aren't within his grasp. I would say that I don't think that war is necessarily inevitable, at least not right now. And this is a crockpot, and the temperature is getting higher in Iraq every day, and I think you're seeing signs that he's beginning to get nervous, and certainly I think that some of that nervousness could channel itself into very nasty ideas about how he might retaliate even from the grave.
The temperature is going to get a whole lot higher, I think. Our time is running down, but Michael Donovan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Michael Donovan is military and terrorism analyst at the Center for Defense Information. He joined us from Alexandria, Virginia. And Richard Betts, it's just been terrific having you. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Richard Betts is director of the Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University. He's author of Suicide from Fear of Death, an article about Iraq's potential use of weapons of mass destruction in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. In a moment, romance novels from Saddam Hussein. This is On Point.
Be aware then, brothers, that victory is yours now, in the past and on the day of final harvesting, in spite of all the hysterical hubbub and the clamor which the enemy has been making. For the enemy has many objectives behind this uproar and self-defeating pandemonium.
That was Saddam Hussein speaking earlier today in a nationally televised speech commemorating Army Day in Iraq. Saddam's reputation as a tyrant is well established. Fewer people know him as Saddam the romance novelist. Scholars and Western intelligence officials are certain that two books published over the past couple of years by an anonymous author were at least co-created by the Iraqi dictator. One of the novels, Zabiba and the King, tells of a melodramatic affair between an insecure king and a beautiful married villager. The king is believed to be a flattering self-portrait by Saddam himself, and Zabiba, the people of Iraq that Saddam loves so passionately. Among the signs that Saddam is the author, Zabiba is raped on January 17th, the same day that the 1991 Gulf War began. For some insight into the mind of Saddam Hussein, here is a translated passage from Zabiba and the King, read by WBUR's Sean Cole.
"Well said, Your Highness," Zabiba commented. "Though you are a king, you are talking this time like us, and understand things as we often do. That is why I have loved you, Your Royal Highness. Yes, a great king orders great things to be done, but the people are the ones who carry them out. You have just mentioned that I often resemble you, but not in everything," the king said, "and that is why you have loved me, Zabiba. So what would have happened if I came to perfectly resemble the people and the nation?" "If this had happened," said Zabiba, "then you would have become a god, or something close to a god, Your Royal Highness, in which case I would be prevented from loving you any more, or I would not like to." "That you would be prevented from this I can understand, but why would you not like me any more if I become a god or something close to a god?" Because I am a human being, Your Royal Highness, and I have loved you as a human being and would like you to retain your human characteristics made of flesh and blood so that I will love you as a woman and not worship you. Cannot godly characteristics be combined with human ones, Zabiba? No, Your Royal Highness. The worship of God educates the people, and if the king's humanity is based on belief, he will be a righteous king. The people will love him, and he will be close to the people and close to God. Although I know that you have got a sharp tongue, Zabiba, I have loved you. Do you know why? Pardon me, Your Royal Highness, I do not know why. I have loved you so that I will not die within my inside, so that I will be close to life and the people, be part of it and be its leader. I do not want to be like these gods who stay in a temple doing nothing except for receiving offerings. I have wanted to be with all of you people, to create life with you and for you, greet the sun with you, and smell palm trees and fresh air, love the flowers, pray for the dead, and condemn treason. When the king was speaking, Zabiba was in her utmost beauty. But when he said, "I condemn treason," Zabiba was alarmed. Her eyes became wide open, and she started murmuring. Do kings really hate treason? Indeed, you see them practicing it abundantly in the corridors of their castles, in the bedchambers of their wives, their maids, and their concubines. But our king does not resemble them in many things. He resembles us more. Then she continued, saying, "So long as he is a king, these characteristics by which he resembles us are exposed to danger, especially if he forgets the tragedy of his youth or is carried away by lust for power. However, he may overcome this if he embraces the cause of the people, if he fights for it with his sword, if he runs into adventures for it and leads us to the peak of glories. Now I really know how to express my humanity, O Zabiba. That is why I will not stray the road. If you find treason, it is somewhere else and not in our kingdom, or more precisely, not among the sons of our people. But I fear your devil, Your Royal Highness, and the devil of the traitors. Does not everyone have a devil of his own, Your Royal Highness? But the devil of the people is too weak to make it commit treason. Or let us say, the people is stronger than its devil, while the kings are weaker. This may happen if the devils of the kings feel that they are about to lose their throne, and that they may keep it only by way of treason, or when their relatives covet power." No sooner did Zabiba utter this last sentence than she noticed a frightening move from behind the curtain where they were standing. As the king was facing her with his back to the curtain, someone came from behind it with a drawn sword. Zabiba shouted, "Beware, Your Royal Highness," and threw herself forcefully on the king to defend him. She knew immediately that the person who drew the sword and who was about to stab the king was the king's cousin and the commander of his army. But Zabiba's chest was closer, so she collapsed on the ground, shouting, "This is treason carried out from inside the king's house, Your Royal Highness." When the king hurled on the traitor and cut his head, he noticed that one of his wives was standing in a corner, waiting to receive the news about the king's death. And then the king went back to Zabiba, hugged and kissed her, and said, "Didn't I tell you that you will not betray me and that your devil will have no power on you?"
A translated passage from the romance novel Zabiba and the King, a work by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. The passage was read by WBUR's Sean Cole. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...